ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Jonathan Zuck, a technologist, visual artist, and educator. As the executive director of the Innovators Network Foundation, Jonathan leads research into the future of work and facilitates pilot projects designed to expand the entrepreneur class around the world. Jonathan is an award-winning photographer and filmmaker with clients around the world. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So first off, how did you get involved with the Innovators Network Foundation? How did that come about?
Well, I actually started the Innovators Network Foundation a number
of years ago.
I started it a number of years ago as a vehicle for training entrepreneurs to be better business people. So there was sort of a focus on tech entrepreneurs that had a good handle on their technology, but not necessarily on how to identify and protect their intellectual property, how to raise funds, things like that.
Is this something that people can just participate in? Do they have to become members? Do they have to pay in to be a part of it? Or is this just something that is available and out there for entrepreneurs? And then is it only available for tech entrepreneurs, or can any entrepreneur access it?
Well, so I should finish the story because we then just recently redirected it to be more focused on future of work issues.
Okay.
And so it's not a member organization in that sense, but it is instead looking to try and do research and potentially get involved in pilot projects associated with global unemployment issues. So things like micro-franchising are some of the pilot projects in which we've become involved. You know, looking for grants to do white papers and other research on how to best accommodate the next labor economy, if you will.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that I know they were talking, I think it was at Davos this last time, of the sort of the fourth industrial revolution, and that we're going to have the potential for mass unemployment because of, and it's unemployment of a certain, of not the type we've seen before where maybe it was blue collar workers, but we're talking about knowledge workers because there's just not as many roles for them. Is that correct? Am I correct in that rephrasing of things?
Well, that's right. I mean, it's hard to predict exactly what's going to happen because very often when there are adjustments in the labor market and jobs go away, different types of jobs then appear. That happened in the last industrial revolution. There are certainly some, and I count myself among them, that believe that this is going to be different, that we are really in this next phase of the economy focused more on automation and the actual removal of human labor. And so I think that we're facing structural unemployment, both in blue collar and white collar sectors in the not too distant future.
Well, when you say, I guess, that there's debate around it, what are the things that you look to that say, here, this is the indicator, this is why I see it being a structural and more permanent issue?
It's not for sure, obviously, right? But
right.
I think that the nature of this is around the incorporation of artificial intelligence in particular that is designed purposefully to decrease the necessity for human intervention into a number of different tasks that are currently performed by people.
Right.
The last industrial revolution was really about moving people off of farms and into the city. And there
right.
was plenty of work for people to do in this new kind of urban economy that got created. In this area, I think that we're going to have to think differently about what employment means, in that there aren't going to be a bunch of full-time jobs created in this new economy, but that instead it's going to be people allocating their in you know multiple activities, maybe being engaged in more artistic pursuits, et cetera. So some of this comes down to how you define it as well. But I believe that the jobs that are going to get created are going to be more like very high-end kind of engineering style jobs and not the kind of jobs that currently run the economy.
Do you foresee potentially sort of a barbell effect where you have sort of very high-end knowledge workers and then very low-end, if you will, like if you think about sort of the Amazon fulfillment warehouse worker where the drone will bring them something and they have to package X number of things in order to keep employed, and it's a human, but it's not very fun, that work environment.
I certainly think we'll see some of that, but a lot of the line working at the Amazon fulfillment houses are being increasingly handled by automated systems as well, right?
Oh, wow.
I mean, Amazon, in fact, purchased a robotics company that specifically had robots that can manage a lot of what's going on in those warehouses. Nothing is 100%, right? It's not like jobs are going to just be eliminated. But the problem is, if you look at the Great Depression, it wasn't like it was 75% unemployment. It was like 29% unemployment, right? So it's not, it doesn't have to be.
It doesn't have to be a huge amount to create a huge impact.
Right. And a lot of disruption. That's right. And so I think you're going to see different types of tasks that are less likely to be automatable in the context of, say, education, healthcare, care for the elderly, childcare, things like that, that are sort of human-to-human interaction that I think we're quite a ways off from automating. And those are also areas where we could see where we would probably benefit from having a flow of available labor, right? I think there's not enough people in those jobs today, so that having more people there would be a good thing. But I think an awful lot of things, even areas that are currently handled by attorneys, are starting to be automated.
Well, that's interesting.
Law degrees, right? So it's a pretty dramatic shift that's coming, I believe.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody from Allen & Company about some AI that was drafting contracts, pretty complex contracts. And that was sort of shocking because, you sort of think, my children are going to be lawyers and doctors and I will be all set. Well, maybe not. Maybe that will not be. Maybe I really want them to be plumbers and electricians and things that can't be outsourced or, that need to be done by hand wherever they are. So one of the things, obviously, if you started with this entrepreneur training of entrepreneurs and then pivoted into this sort of microfunding, obviously entrepreneurship is something that could perhaps create opportunity for people, right?
That's exactly what you're looking at. And so it's a natural progression from what we were doing. I think where the shift in my thinking that has occurred is that trying to expand the number of, I guess I'll call them classic entrepreneurs, where I've got an idea, I'm going to go out and get funding for the idea, I'm going to build a business and make it successful. Expanding the number of entrepreneurs like that is very labor intensive because it requires a very broad set of skills to be successful. And so what I'd like to see is maybe expand the entrepreneur class to include people that just have, if you will, chutzpah, the kind of people that save up their money and buy a KFC franchise or a Domino's franchise or an existing business as a dry cleaner or something like that, where, I don't need to have the idea for the next Instagram to be an entrepreneur, but that I still have sort of entrepreneurial energy to bring to an endeavor.
Well, isn't that actually the lion's share of entrepreneurship in our country? Isn't this sort of mammoth and innovative entrepreneurship, but it's the restaurant, it's the small business owner, it's the person who's sort of forging ahead on their own. Yeah.
And that's right. But if you look at, what the cost of entry is into a typical franchise or something, it's quite high. And so one of the things that we're looking at around the world is this notion of micro franchising. And so in some ways, it's a little bit like Uber or Lyft model, that my only investment is a car and I can find a way to make that profitable for me. In Africa, it might be getting medicines out of urban areas into rural areas or getting farm goods into urban areas, because nearly half of all food that gets farmed spoils before it makes it to market. Mm. Things like that could benefit from a sort of distributed transportation industry, for example.
I see.
And so I think looking for that same business model of a franchise, which is basically, here's a business model that's already been designed. Here's a binder with all the things you're supposed to do. Here's a customer support number. Maybe here's a supply chain, you know, et cetera. And all you need to do is work on promoting it in your area or executing on it. That can be a more expanded class, even then the restaurant owner, which is a pretty high barrier to entry, having done it a couple of times myself.
So you know.
Yeah.
Well, you know, as a small business vendor serving entertainment brands, one of the things that I'm seeing not only with my customer base is consolidation, but in among my competitive set, there's consolidation going on. Do you think that this is a sort of a cyclical thing where you're going to have, you know, micro entrepreneurship, which will then gel together into larger businesses and then split up again? Or is it really going to stay very small? You know, because if you're talking about sort of Uberfication, where it's really one off. I mean, although saying all the Uber drivers are contract workers is a bit of a cheat, I think.
Well, part of the issue, I think, is not only retraining the workforce, but kind of retraining the economy to handle these new structures. And so our dependence on employers for healthcare, for example, is something that we may need to move away from towards more individualized healthcare that's more easier to get, et cetera. And we got some of, you know, with the move to ACA.
Right.
So thinking in terms of how to, I mean, trying to make the new economy behave like the old economy, I think is one of the problems that we have. I mean, I hear like Amazon being asked by an economic development officer, you know, like, when will you open a fulfillment center in my state? And so the idea that you're going to come to a new economy company and say, can I get you to behave like an old economy company? Because that's all I know, right? When all I have is a hammer, every problem becomes a nail. So the question is, should state economic development funds, for example, should some of them be allocated not just to big companies moving manufacturing facilities, but should they be allocating to workforce retraining to help people build their own businesses?
Well, absolutely. You know, it's interesting that exact issue. I'm a woman-owned business, and whenever dealing with any of the organizations for minority or women-owned businesses, you run into this incredible bureaucracy of, you know, well, you're a manufacturer, you're this or the other thing. And it's like, well, no, that doesn't really fit what I do. That's not really who I am or what I am. And it just, the facing piece that faces, you know, the government facing piece is really lags. I mean, it lags not only lags to, you know, where the economy is going, but it isn't even facing where the economy is today. It's sort of designed for 1950. And I think that this is also an inherent challenge because, you know, we don't have labor unions. We don't, you know, how do we encourage people to vote in politicians who, you know, this is a complex problem. You know, it isn't because of a foreign worker that things are disrupting. This is just happening. So how do you get people to speak honestly about the problem and honestly about the solution? Because some of these solutions aren't comfortable.
They're not, because they are very new and they are not. It's a little bit like when you go to get a new dog and you say to yourself, well, my last dog was a lab and I really enjoyed my last dog, so I'm going to get another lab because he'll be just like the one that I had before. And first thing is that no dogs are the same. But more importantly, your memory of your lab is when that dog was like 8 years old.
Not a puppy.
And not a puppy, right? And
yes.
So you're sitting here staring down an 8-month-old puppy that's as big as your old dog is, but has the emotional maturity of a puppy, and saying, why can't you be more like this 9-year-old dog that I love so much? And the same thing is true here, that the idea of pensions and employee-led healthcare and vacation time and things like that, that were very centered on large-scale employment, you know, there's a certain comfort to that, both from the standpoint of a policymaker, because the number of entities I need to deal with is much smaller than if I'm dealing with individuals. and from the standpoint of the individual, because here I have this predictability that I'll get this job, and if I get to this certain level, then I'll get 4 weeks of vacation instead of 2 weeks of vacation. And, you know, you look at the person that owns the restaurant, they don't have any of that.
Right.
They're putting all that together themselves, and the system is not wired to help them.
No.
The extent to which we are trying to facilitate a individually or employee, or I don't want to say employee, an individual-centric economy.
Well, it's almost
something
also,
that will change and become uncomfortable for everyone.
We should all be equally uncomfortable. Well, it sort of reminds me of Mondragon Corporation. I don't know if you are familiar with that. It was a worker cooperative based in the Basque region of Spain, where a bit of an experiment, and were the workers going to feel like workers or were they going to feel like owners, and would they behave like entrepreneurs, or would they behave like workers? And I think, if I remember correctly, go back to my labor classes a million years ago, they behave more like entrepreneurs, but it really is a different mindset. And so if you're an entrepreneur, you don't just get a raise because you've been in the job for 2 years. You only get a raise if you get smarter, more clever, and do something better. And so nobody hands things to you. You must be very self-directed. So it's really about everybody changing their own behavior. It's sort of a massive behavior shift, right? I mean, if it's going to really be resting on each individual to forge their way.
That's right. And I guess what's interesting is trying to find ways and reform institutions to make that less intimidating. In other words, not only do you need to kind of show the initiative from the standpoint of your work, you have to show the initiative from the standpoint of your healthcare. You have to show the initiative from the standpoint of how you're doing your retirement planning. You have to show your initiative for how you're negotiating with, you know, local neighborhood, groups about your business, et cetera. I mean, there's just so much else that's piled on top of you that's beyond then the actual work you're trying to do as an entrepreneur. And so kind of rewiring, you know, the expectations of these institutions to be more in service to individuals, I think could go a long way.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I think one of the things as a small business, which works with freelancers, the issue is the government says people can be freelancers and yet penalizes small businesses for hiring freelancers, because the minute you give anybody a directive, they say, oh, you're actually employing them, so you need to pay payroll taxes. And you're like, well, they're a freelancer. And so the rules aren't necessarily set up for it yet. I mean, what's the role of the government and how do they set this up? And also, do you see large corporations, as I was saying, you know, we have these giant media corporations and increasingly, you know, there's consolidation. Do you think that they will become skinny? That they'll be large in terms of revenue, but skinny in terms of staffing? Do you think that there'll be collections of free agents? How do you envision some of these large corporations shifting?
Well, I guess, again, I don't feel the need to make anybody make a shift that doesn't work for them. And I think what you'll see is that corporations will try to find, you know, ways to be control their costs, to increase their consistency. So as soon as driverless cars are a reliable thing, I mean, I think we can expect Uber to make a change to driverless cars.
Right.
And so the, you know, what corporations do and large corporations do is a different issue, but that, you know, how we facilitate people's mobility, being able to take, you know, whatever plans they have for healthcare or retirement and manage them independently, but still do it with relative comfort or ease, but, you know, move from types of employment to types of employment or multiple types of employment, et cetera, I think is going to be a pretty important transitional phase for the economy. I personally believe that there's reforms that are going to need to happen even in the way that we teach children about their self-worth and employment, because I think in the end, there aren't going to be enough jobs in the way that we've come to think about them for the number of people that there are. They're just not going to exist. And so the question then becomes, how do you, as an economy, in theory, you pay for all of this with increased productivity of these companies, right?
And so, well, but do people share? I mean, does everybody share in the benefit from that, or is the wealth concentrated in the few? Do you see sort of guaranteed basic incomes for folks, because, you know, how do you, I mean, I guess this is all sort of riffing on where you think it could go, because obviously nobody does know where it will go. I mean, even just taking driverless cars, when you think about that, when you think of what could happen to the trucking industry, when you think about all of, like, think about real estate in Los Angeles, when all of those parking garages are no longer necessary because cars will drive themselves home.
Right.
So
I think that's those are all valid questions. And I think that some form of universal basic income is inevitable. Right. And so the question is, when is the right time? What is the right amount? I think there's an awful lot of work to do actually figure that out. And part of the philosophy behind UBI is that everyone would get it so that there wouldn't be a stigma associated with getting it. Right. I mean, that's what differentiates it from welfare, is that right now we have this distinction between people that are engines of the economy and people that aren't. And the number of people that sort of get ground up in the gears of that distinction is higher than it ought to be. And if we took the stigma of it away, it could make a big difference. In other words, that you still sort of fund it in the same way, et cetera, but you don't make it something that it's just for people that are, you know, are unable to be employed, because you make employment less of a status symbol that it is today and make it more something that people want to have show initiative to do something more they can, but there is some baseline that covers people's living.
I think culturally, I think that's a tough sell. I mean, just if you think about the sort of Horatio Alger up by the bootstraps, you know, culture.
Right. When we're at 25% unemployment, I think that's when you'll see cultural changes. Because the very people that believe in that are going to be the people that don't have jobs available to them.
Right. Can this happen without revolution? I mean, do you think that this is potentially going to lead to some civil unrest, if you will? I mean, if we look at, you know, past industrial revolutions, some of the things that have happened where you have increased nationalism and xenophobia and some, you know,
right.
Those things are also on the rise, and it's sort of interesting to see the parallels there.
No, I agree completely. I mean, I think that we have a bit of a revolution happening, and we have a lot of demagoguery around ridiculous issues like immigration as deflection for what's going on in the economy. And I think some reforms will have to happen to prevent what you're calling civil unrest, because there are these indicators that are in the offing right now. And I think that I hope that people will take them as signifiers that we can't be completely laissez-faire about it.
Right. Well, I think that it's, again, though, I think culturally it's a challenge. I mean, sure. One of the things, like in America, very quickly in conversation, you meet an adult, the question of what do you do comes up. When you're in Europe, it doesn't necessarily come up right away. You know, different cultures,
that's right.
You aren't as defined by your work, but here, absolutely. And it's what have you done? What have you built? And even the sort of the national character of people coming here, leaving their home countries to build and be something that they couldn't be in their home country. So I think it's an interesting challenge for sure. I also think that the micro franchising is really interesting, because franchises are so expensive right now. And what a wonderful thing if you could have somebody explain, here's the business, here's the plan, here's how you do it. These are the tools. Now you can be successful, or you've got some guardrails to be successful.
That's exactly right. Is that, and then you can focus your energy on being productive and on being creative on the margins, as opposed to having to come up with something from scratch.
Do you see this kind of thing cross industry? So, you know, obviously we have human high touch in the service end of things, where you're actually hands on with healthcare or elder care, child care. But what about other industries? Do you see this? If you were to think of the mix that you anticipate that you'd have a certain amount, like how much of the population, if we think like 25% is going to be underemployed, but perhaps within that, would they be micro franchising, or how do you think of the mix?
Well, I mean, this is all crystal ball stuff, obviously. I mean,
tell me the future.
But I think that I don't think it's going to be an easy road, but I foresee a world down the road, say 50 years from now, where, you know, you have probably some form of UBI that allows people to pursue activities that haven't been typically high paying, but that people are making enough money to make a living, and whether that's the arts or education and things like that, and that you'll still have people that are billionaires that are building things. I don't think that that will stop. I think there will still be income disparity, but I think that what will be necessary is to kind of raise the bar for the folks that are not employed in typical money-making activities, right? And I think that that's going to happen over time, and there's going to be a lot of pain associated with that transition. But I think, you know, some of the things that can help in the near term is kind of getting out of the way of people engaging with the economy as an individual, which has to do with like continuing to reform healthcare, continuing to, you know, there's weird things like there's crazy licensing laws in multiple states, so that if you're a hairdresser in one state, you have to get relicensed if you move to another state. That has an effect on labor mobility, for example.
Sure, but then you have sort of states' rights, federal rights, and you're bucking up against kind of cultural differences.
No, you're really bucking up against state-level protectionism and things like that. That isn't really cultural. It's money, right? But as these issues increase in urgency, I think we'll start to see some increased flexibility. So it's about thinking in the near term about how to make the peer-to-peer economy more effective, how you, teach people in your, use some of your economic development dollars to teach people in your state how to engage in the peer-to-peer economy rather than just being focused on how to create manufacturing jobs in a zero-sum race against the state next to you, right?
Right. Well, sort of we've run through our time, so I'll leave with one last question, and that is, if I am I'm a small business owner, I'm working in a creative field, what are some of the things that I can do to look ahead and think smart? And then also, if I'm a large entertainment company and I'm an employee, you know, or if I'm an employee in a large entertainment company or any large company, what are some of the things I should be thinking about if my career is, you know, going to last a bit longer? What are some of the things I should be aware of?
Well, I think there's a number of different areas. I mean, we're working on trying to think about these things in real time, and maybe developing an alternative for the unemployment index, for example, that helps to better track people's engagement in the economy, as opposed to just this binary of whether you're unemployed or not, right? And so I think that people that are independent now need to be thinking about constant reinvention of their skill set, that this notion that your skills development can be terminal and you can just enter the workforce until you retire is something you have to get rid of, whether you're working independently or within a corporation. I've told people that are employees in large organizations, they need to act like entrepreneurs to be successful inside those organizations as well. I mean, unless you're a beneficiary of the Peter Principle, the real way to succeed in an organization. So I don't think that's changed. And, you know, beyond that, I think it's probably getting involved politically, as you say, and making sure that policymakers are aware of the need to begin to think in terms of individual engagement in the economy instead of this kind of large entity engagement that has ruled the economy since the last Industrial Revolution.
Right. Well, thank you so much for spending the time with us to talk about this stuff. I love thinking about it, and I so appreciate your sharing the thinking and things that you're doing. So thank you very much for that.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, and I'm happy to talk anytime.
I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who have helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, Jonathan Zuck. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.